administration, healthcare, pensions, social welfare, education, and the fight against corruption. According to the memo, Berlin will demand that Greece run a budget surplus of 4.5% of its gross domestic product, GDP. This would mean that nearly 10 billion euro per year would be sucked out of Greece's devastated economy in order to pay off its creditors. Yesterday, the European Central Bank, ECB, also banned the use of Greek government debt as collateral for loans sought by Greek banks, saying that it is currently not possible to assume a successful conclusion of the program review. Greek Finance Minister Yanis Varoufakis has proposed that Athens raise 10 billion euro by issuing short-term treasury bills to provide bridging finance over the next 3 months while a new long-term debt agreement is worked out. Unless some sort of financing measures are established, the government could be hard-pressed for cash. Jacob Kierkegaard of the Peterson Institute for International Economics said, "This is clearly the ECB signaling to the Greek government, you're going to have to talk to international lenders and get a deal. Otherwise, really bad things are going to happen." Varoufakis traveled yesterday to Frankfurt to meet ECB chief Mario Draghi. Varoufakis abased himself before both Draghi and German Finance Minister Wolfgang Schäuble, one of the leading architects of austerity measures against Greece. "We established an excellent line of communication that gives me great encouragement for the future," Varoufakis said at ECB headquarters. "I am now proceeding to Berlin, where I am extremely eager to meet not with just the finance minister, but with the intellectual force behind the project of European Monetary Union, Mr. Schäuble. I look forward to it." Varoufakis said Berlin could count on Syriza to go further than previous right-wing or social democratic governments in Greece. "I will try to be as charming as I can in Berlin," Varoufakis declared. "I will tell Mr. Schäuble that we may be a left-wing riffraff, but he can count on our Syriza movement to clear away Greece's cartels and oligarchies and push through the deep reforms of the Greek state that governments before us refused to do." Deep reforms is a reference to measures aimed at the opening up of the Greek economy more fully to European and international capital. Speaking to the German weekly Die Zeit, Varoufakis called Greece a bankrupt country and said that Syriza would ask major international financial institutions to help determine its policies. "We've approached José Ángel Gurría, the Secretary General of the OECD, Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the Organization of Industrialized Countries. He is supposed to help us put together a reform program," Varoufakis said. Syriza is opposed to the only possible progressive settlement to the euro crisis, the repudiation of the Greek debt and the expropriation of the banks by the European working class. Instead, amid rising exploitation and anger in the working class, reflected in the outcome of the Greek elections, it is promoting illusions in reactionary governments across Europe. Also today on the World Socialist website, German ruling class demands that austerity debt payments continue after Greek elections. Testimony of Moussaoui in civil suit implicates Saudi monarchy as principal sponsor of Al-Qaeda. Deadliest commuter rail crash in New York history kills 6. Chicago mayoral race enters final weeks. Notes on police violence in America. Video shows Baltimore school cop beating 13-year-old girl with baton. People from wealthy families 8 times more likely to graduate college. Falling oil prices trigger new layoffs, budget cuts in Louisiana and Texas. U.S. spy bases in Australia central to war plans against China. Australian High Court rubber stamps detention of refugees at sea. Former Maldives president mounts challenge to government. Oil slump triggers North Sea crisis. Further evidence of deaths due to UK welfare benefits sanctions. And an arts review, The Humbling, an actor who can no longer act. All this and more can be found at wsws.org. For the World Socialist website, this has been Christine Schofield.
The World Socialist website is published by the International Committee of the Fourth International, the ICFI, the leadership of the World Socialist Movement, the Fourth International founded by Leon Trotsky in 1938. The World Socialist website relies entirely on the donations of readers and listeners for financial support. To give to the WSWS or to set up a regular monthly contribution, go to wsws.org/donate. We urge our listeners to join the International Committee of the Fourth International and one of its affiliated political parties and take up the struggle for socialism.
Coming up next, Informativo Pacifica.
A continuación, Informativo Pacifica.
No te la pierdas.
Because we are the 99%.
El tema de Guantánamo no está en la mesa de conversaciones. Quiero dejar claro que lo que nosotros estamos tratando en este momento es sobre el restablecimiento de las relaciones diplomáticas, que es solo el primer paso de la normalización.
La administración Obama deja claro que continuará presionando a Cuba para que cambie su sistema político. Conmemoran en Venezuela el 23 aniversario del levantamiento militar liderado por Hugo Chávez.
Yo, ante el país y ante ustedes, asumo la responsabilidad de ese movimiento militar bolivariano.
Del fracaso militar de ese día, germinaría el triunfo del proyecto bolivariano. Y en España, el partido Podemos se convierte en la segunda fuerza política. A continuación, detalles de estas y otras noticias en la edición de hoy del Informativo Pacífica. Les saluda Norma Martínez. Acompáñenos. Iniciamos con noticias de México. Con el fallecimiento de la enfermera Mónica Horta, aumentó a 4 el número de víctimas mortales por la explosión y derrumbe de un hospital materno-infantil en la Ciudad de México el pasado jueves. Horta rescató a varios recién nacidos pese a que sus compañeros la instaban a desalojar el inmueble, señalaron autoridades. La madre, de 32 años de edad, deja 3 pequeños huérfanos. Se informa que todavía permanecen hospitalizadas 17 personas en centros médicos, entre ellas 9 recién nacidos. De acuerdo al jefe de la Ciudad de México, bajo una nueva ley, personal de Gas Express Nieto, compañía responsable de la fuga que provocara la explosión y el derrumbe del hospital, no tendría que ser encarcelado si se repara el daño. La subsecretaria de Estado para América Latina, Roberta Jacobson, dejó claro el miércoles que Estados Unidos continuará presionando a Cuba para que cambie su sistema político. Durante una audiencia de la Comisión de Relaciones Exteriores de la Cámara Baja, Jacobson dijo que el diálogo con Cuba para restablecer relaciones diplomáticas entre los dos países no incluye regresar al territorio de Guantánamo, donde Estados Unidos mantiene una base militar.
En el Congreso estadounidense se realizó la audiencia titulada Cuba abordando el súbito giro del gobierno. Paradójicamente, ahí se constató que muchas posturas de Estados Unidos aún no cambian ni giran.
El tema de Guantánamo no está en la mesa de conversaciones. Quiero dejar claro que lo que nosotros estamos tratando en este momento es sobre el restablecimiento de las relaciones diplomáticas, que es solo el primer paso de la normalización.
Desde que todavía queda mucho por luchar, el Comité Internacional por la Liberación de los 5 esta semana se reúne en Washington, llenos de júbilo porque dicen que no es fácil obtener victorias tan importantes en vida, aseguran que faltan muchas más.
Uno de los trabajos nuestro fundamental va a ser informar, como hacíamos con el caso de los 5, pero informar sobre la realidad cubana y a su vez enfocarnos en algunos temas fundamentales, por ejemplo el bloqueo.
También demandan la devolución del territorio de Guantánamo a la isla, la eliminación de la llamada ley de ajuste cubano. Esperan que Estados Unidos se siente a la mesa de negociaciones de igual a igual.
La gente común estadounidense tiene muchas formas por las que puede verse beneficiada con la normalización de las relaciones con Cuba. Y se puede abogar para que suceda desde distintos niveles. Pero esto tiene que estar basado en la soberanía cubana, reconociendo que Cuba tiene el derecho de determinar sus propias relaciones internas y su destino.
Precisamente porque así lo sienten, la Organización por la Paz, Code Pink, lidera un próximo viaje a Cuba con 150 activistas de todas las ramas para intercambiar experiencias.
En nuestro grupo todos tenemos razones para ir, pero lo que nos conecta especialmente es que creemos que tiene mucho más sentido relacionarnos con nuestros vecinos en una forma de respeto mutuo y diplomacia que continuar con las sanciones y con el bloqueo.
Otra de las demandas inmediatas de movimientos sociales es sacar a Cuba de la lista de patrocinadores del terrorismo. Francesca Emanuele, Washington DC, Telesur.
Ashton B. Carter, nominado por el presidente Barack Obama como secretario de Defensa después de que se forzara la renuncia de Chuck Hagel, dijo estar a favor de proveer armas pesadas a Ucrania para combatir a los grupos que reclaman autonomía. Durante la audiencia de confirmación ante un comité del Congreso, Ashton B. Carter dijo que apoya la idea de armar al gobierno de Kiev, al que organismos de derechos humanos acusan de ataques indiscriminados contra la población de Donetsk y Lugansk y el uso de armas prohibidas. Carter ocupó el segundo puesto más importante en el Pentágono y tiene relaciones personales con la industria armamentista de Estados Unidos. El titular de la Agencia de Inteligencia de Defensa de los Estados Unidos, Vincent Stewart, afirma que Rusia y China podrían ser las mayores amenazas para la seguridad nacional de la Unión Americana. Ignacio Jubilla reporta.
Esta vez fue el vocero de la Casa Blanca, Josh Earnest, quien declaró que la intención de Estados Unidos es aislar a Rusia de las actividades que puedan, según el punto de vista de la administración Obama, interferir en la regularización pacífica de la situación en Ucrania. Earnest dijo que Washington está evaluando constantemente la estrategia en ese país y aseguró que la Casa Blanca persigue dos objetivos. Uno de ellos sería aislar a la gerencia política de Rusia de las actividades que pueden desestabilizar, como decíamos, la situación en el este ucraniano. Y el segundo objetivo sería apoyar a nuestros amigos, dijo Earnest, en Ucrania en este tiempo tan difícil. Bueno, según sus palabras, este apoyo supone facilitar ayuda militar no letal y expedir créditos. Vamos a recordar que el Departamento de Estado de los Estados Unidos se niega a dar hasta el momento detalles o hacer pronósticos de cómo va a terminar la discusión en Estados Unidos sobre la posibilidad de suministrar armas a Kiev. Esa es una versión que fue cobrando peso en los últimos días, y en la rueda de prensa de este martes, Jen Psaki declaró escuetamente que no estaba dispuesta a hacer ningún tipo de especulaciones o suposiciones al respecto. También subrayó la vocera del Departamento de Estado que, desde el punto de vista del Poder Ejecutivo en los Estados Unidos, un acceso correcto hacia la superación de la crisis en Ucrania sería su regulación a través del diálogo y no entonces con la ayuda de la fuerza militar. Jen Psaki dijo además que el Departamento de Estado insta a ambas partes del conflicto a evitar víctimas entre los civiles. Sin embargo, destacó que siguen creyendo que las acciones agresivas provienen desde los separatistas. Seguimos preocupados por las acciones agresivas de Rusia, dijo, y de los separatistas a quienes apoyan y los que han entrado en el territorio de Ucrania de forma ilegal. Esto es lo que aseguraba la funcionaria. Sin embargo, algunos analistas destacan que no hay que olvidarse del rol injerencista del gobierno de Estados Unidos en la crisis que hoy atraviesa Ucrania. Vamos a escuchar la palabra de uno de ellos.
No tengo la menor duda de que quien realmente es injerencista en este conflicto que afecta a Ucrania y también al Donbass es Estados Unidos. Estados Unidos y la Unión Europea comenzaron este conflicto. Ellos fueron los que destituyeron al gobierno legítimamente elegido de Ucrania. Ellos fueron los que armaron, equiparon y pusieron suficiente cantidad de dinero a los fascistas ucranianos.
Y por último, otra declaración que ha causado revuelo aquí en los Estados Unidos provino de la Armada del país, que apuntó esta vez no solo a Rusia, sino también a China. El teniente general de la Infantería Marítima del país, Vincent Stewart, destacó que tanto Rusia como China pueden resultar las mayores amenazas para la seguridad de los Estados Unidos. Y por eso, dijo este teniente, debemos examinar con con atención sus posibilidades y entender de qué son capaces, porque representan una amenaza para nuestra nación. Y concluyó entonces, debemos mantener el equilibrio, porque de lo contrario se nos puede escapar algo más en el mundo. Declaraciones de un representante, como decíamos, de la Armada de los Estados Unidos.
El presentador inglés Max Kaiser ha declarado que no existe justicia en Estados Unidos ni en el Reino Unido. Kaiser hizo su comentario reaccionando a la posición del Departamento de Justicia estadounidense de no juzgar a News Corp ni a su filial 21st Century Fox Inc. del magnate Rupert Murdoch. La empresa está acusada de llevar a cabo intervenciones telefónicas con fines sensacionalistas a varias celebridades e incluso familiares de las víctimas de los atentados del 11 de septiembre. La justicia norteamericana alega que no hay pruebas suficientes que demuestren que se ha violado la legislación del país. Max Kaiser calificó de auténticos terroristas al ex primer ministro británico Tony Blair y al magnate mediático Rupert Murdoch, a quienes acusó de montar la guerra en Irak. El cierre de la investigación en Estados Unidos significa que el magnate de las telecomunicaciones se ahorra una multa de más de 850 millones de dólares. El secretario general de la Unión de Naciones Suramericanas, UNASUR, Ernesto Samper, rechazó los intentos de desestabilización de Venezuela que se impulsan desde Estados Unidos.
Quiero reiterar públicamente que la posición de UNASUR, que está en su carta constitutiva y ha sido refrendada en el Tratado de Cláusula Democrática, es absolutamente clara y contundente en señalar que cualquier intento de desestabilización que se produzca en una democracia o intento de desestabilizar un gobierno contará con el rechazo unánime de todos los países de UNASUR. La democracia con la paz y los derechos humanos forman parte de la trilogía fundamental de UNASUR.
El pueblo venezolano conmemoró el miércoles 4 de febrero el 23 aniversario del fallido levantamiento armado de un grupo de militares liderados por Hugo Chávez contra el gobierno de Carlos Andrés Pérez. El intento de derrocar al presidente neoliberal fue en respuesta a la represión ordenada por Pérez contra el pueblo venezolano en los barrios de la capital, en el evento conocido como Caracazo, ocurrido en febrero de 1989. Ante la derrota, el comandante Hugo Chávez asumió su responsabilidad frente al mundo y fue enviado a la cárcel, pero de ese fracaso germinó su triunfo por la vía electoral años más tarde.
Yo, ante el país, y ante ustedes, asumo...
And es todo en español, y entonces en inglés. Welcome to Bathroom Spears Broadsides. We're a bit late. We have special in-studio guest Pat Colby, and perhaps a few call-ins, so don't go away.
I'm tired of moon songs, starring of tune songs, they simply make me mad. And ditties romantic, drive me frantic, I think they're all full of pap. History's making, nations are quaking, rising of stars above. For while we are waiting, Father Time's creating new things to be singing of. Sing me a song with social significance. All other tunes are taboo. I want a ditty with heat in it, appealing with feeling and meat in it. Sing me a song with social significance, or you can sing till you're blue. Meaning shine from every line.
Well, that tape seems to be going downhill fast. Welcome to Bathrop Spears Broadsides, and welcome studio guest Pat Colby. Hey, Pat.
Hi.
So, it's been a while since you've been on the air.
Yeah, a long time.
Let's see if I could turn this down a bit, adjust the levels. Let's see if we can get somewhere. So, I've got a couple things planned for today. We don't have the city council agenda for next Tuesday. We do know that SCRAM, Santa Cruz Against Militarization, what is it, SCRAM, Santa Cruz Against Santa Cruz Resistance. There we go, Against Militarization, is going to be showing up at 4:30 on Tuesday at the city council. And I know you had a crane and comestibles planned for tomorrow, but then the rain is going to kind of rain you out, right?
Yeah, if it's not raining, we'll still do that. But if it's raining, which it probably will, we won't be on Pacific educating the public about what's going on.
And, of course, Food Not Bombs will be at the its usual place at the outside the main post office, perhaps under the eaves of the post office, which is where Food Not Bombs goes when it rains, sometimes pursued by angry postal officials. But that's where Huff often shows up with its small claims court Stop the Sleep Busters campaign. And if I'm in town, I think I probably will be. Might not be, but I think I probably will be. I'll be there, and hopefully somebody will be there. If you have tickets, if you've gotten tickets for sleeping, if you have friends who've gotten tickets for sleeping in the last 6 months, please bring them there. We want you to fill out a claim against the city for $2,500. Can't guarantee you'll get a penny of it, but it will, to some extent, hold them to account. But, Pat, you've been working on another issue which you haven't really discussed a lot on air. I've mentioned it kind of in passing. I think Micah Posner sent me an email about it, which I may have forwarded to you.
Maybe not. I haven't seen my emails today.
It
That's great that he knows about
it.
It
was a week
now.
Ago, or maybe a few days ago, anyway.
I didn't get it.
But I know that, you know, we did cover about 6 months or 8 months ago hearings before it was then Rochelle Noroyan's Transportation Commission, and concerns by some neighbors that homeless recyclers or non-homeless recyclers were stealing bicycles, taking them to recycling centers that were not then adequately monitoring.
And ladders, too.
What they were getting, ladders, different things like that. And the Transportation Commission, as I remember, and I don't have a really clear recollection, I haven't reviewed it, I either went to one of their hearings or I reviewed one of their hearings. I must have gone because I don't think they were doing much in the way of video and audio, though maybe they were. I don't know. But they said, you know, hey, state law requires them to have recycling centers open. And so they had, at that time, there were two recycling centers in Santa Cruz open. But your investigations have led you to conclude that there's been a shutting down of the centers, and that's what I hear from homeless people, too.
Right. They're both shut down. So they shut down the west side, which was the best one, and that comes from a lot of people that I ran into. A couple weeks ago before I got sick, I was able to go to recycling on 41st. I started there, and they were closed. And then I'd been speaking with a woman up in Sacramento who handles all the compliance. And it turns out that Santa Cruz is completely out of compliance. There's supposed to be a recycling center in different, not just one, but open ones in different neighborhoods. So when the recycling center was closed because of neighborhood complaints, which there are no houses, but the thing closest to the west side is the New Leaf Market. They were their neighbors right next door, so perhaps they had a problem with all the supposed bums that were coming to recycle. But that Rochelle, I have on video saying at the tenants' forum when she was running for city council. But it isn't houses there, so this neighborhood is light, industrial, and New Leaf, so that's surprising.
Let me understand this. Where were the two recycling centers that were open before in Santa Cruz?
There was one on West Side on Fair Street, and then there was, it's not really a recycling center, but it's more of a self-serve at the Costco parking lot where they have the gas. And they're supposed to have not one, but because of the size of Santa Cruz, they're supposed to have more than one open. And when they closed down the west side, they illegally did it because they're supposed to be required stores that have to take your recycling when a recycling center is shut down. So since I did alert the woman in Sacramento, she's since sent out, it's been about 30 days now, letters to New Leaf on West Side and Safeway that now they are required, she called it affidavits, that they're now required to take recycling because that recycling center was shut down. And she also apologized profusely to the people of Santa Cruz that were affected by this, that they weren't notified by the city about the West Side one being shut down. So the letters that give them 60 days notice that they're going to have to start taking the recycling was never given out. And then through somebody that contacted me, because they were really frustrated because they recycle once a month because they're a poor person and their income is so low, and so they count on that $25 to $30 every month to be able to afford food. So they count on, which is the state guarantees, we're going to take this deposit from you for this bottle, and to encourage you to recycle it, we're guaranteeing that you'll get that money back, although in Santa Cruz it's nearly impossible. So what I did find is...
What is nearly impossible?
To recycle those things in the city of Santa Cruz. You know, and I hate to break the bubble here, but when I did finally go and recycle on this one Thursday, I ended up at Knob Hill. It took about 4 hours to recycle $2.15. And sorry to break people's bubbles, but there was about 15 people there. I talked to everyone, and there was only one homeless person, and one kind of more seemed like a person that goes through garbage cans and not garbage cans, but, you know, trash and stuff and picks up recycles. So that was only 2 out of 15. The majority were people that there was like middle class people that have kids, soccer moms, that recycle to get the money back because their children drink lots of soda and different beverages that have the deposit, which they rightfully just wanted their deposit back, and half of them had to leave because the recycling center, the guys that were running it didn't take their lunch at the right time because they're so overwhelmed. This is in Capitola I had to go. And they're so overwhelmed because of Santa Cruz dropping the ball and not doing its part that it's pushing all the problem onto Capitola, SoCal, and Aptos, so there isn't enough recycling centers to meet the demands. And so there was a lot of angry people. At that time, I didn't have the complaint number to call. But it's really important for people, because I did the initial call, and I let the lady know. In a minute or so, I'll tell you why this is going on, because you have to say, why is it being blocked? Why am I being stopped from recycling? But mainly, the number to call is 1-800-RECYCLE. Call it often, call it all the time, whenever the recycling isn't open, when it's supposed to be open, when recycling plants aren't available, when stores, required stores, aren't taking the right amount they're supposed to take unlimited.
And what stores are required?
Well, every store in a neighborhood is required, especially when there's no recycling center in that neighborhood. So as of in about 30 more days, New Leaf will West Side on Fair Street will be a required store, and so will Safeway. Because when I went in, they didn't know anything about it. So because of the shutdown, which they say they shut it down because of homeless bums and because they weren't following the rules.
Who said this?
Rochelle did. I have that on video.
So this is a statement she made at the tenant forum last
fall. Right, and she also stated this stuff in an article in the Sentinel.
Now, wait a minute. She said that particularly, specifically, Safeway and New Leaf said they were not receiving recycling.
No.
Are you talking about the recycling centers?
No, the recycling center. She said that they weren't doing all the things they were certified with their records to do, so they shut down the one on Fair Street, which is the cleanest, best facility I've ever seen.
So who shut down the one on Fair Street?
Rochelle and her public works transportation.
You know that because I understood they couldn't do that, and instead there was a different reason it closed. But I'm not sure.
Well, she claims that it was closed because there was theft of ladders and angry meth tweaker bums were going through the recycling bins that the city owns.
Did she claim that was why it was shut down?
Or she said that was one of the reasons.
Or did she say that was an abuse that was happening and it was a good thing that it was shut down?
Well, yeah, she did state that it was a good thing.
So there's a difference. They might have been shut down for other reasons, and she might have wanted to see it shut down for the specific reasons that were brought to her Transportation Commission by a group of people who seemed to be...
Well, it's Public Works and Transportation.
Public Works. Who seemed to be concerned about, you know, particularly focusing on homeless people. Or I guess they were talking about stolen stuff that they worried that... to some extent was being where homeless people were involved, though they didn't have any evidence of that I'm aware of. At least it wasn't presented at that meeting.
And as I saw when I went to recycle...
But again, I want to ask you that question because I'm not...
There's two reasons they said they shut it down.
Wait, I'm not clear. I'm sorry. I want to get this clear. She said nothing about New Leaf and about the other centers that are opening up. And have they always been... What has been their policy on recycling?
Well, they should have been required once that was shut down.
What was their policy before it was shut down? And when was it? When were the two recycling centers that are one? I guess one was in Costco's and one was...
One was in Costco's, and that was closed down in November or earlier. And the one on the west side had been closed down for 6 or more months. So by California regulations and compliance laws, when they shut down that west side one over 6 months ago, they were supposed to have sent out 60-day letters to New Leaf on Fair Street and to Safeway on Mission that they were now required stores.
So, again, my question, which I'd like you to answer if you can, is whether New Leaf and Safeway took recycling prior to...
No, they didn't.
And
this I went into the stores and asked.
So, throughout their history, they've never taken recycling at these places?
Because that West Side Recycling was open.
And, I mean, what did they do? You know, I guess you don't know. Do you know what they do if somebody comes and says, I want to recycle?
They say they don't take it.
Would they send it to the recycling center?
They say you have to go to the recycling center.
Are you guessing?
No, that's what... When I went into Safeway and New Leaf, they both said that they don't take it there. And I said, well, you know, I was told that you guys are required stores because the neighborhood one shut down, and they didn't know anything about it.
Now, what stores are required? Just these two, or are other stores also required to take recycling?
Other stores are required, but let me go back to answer the other reason that Rochelle Narayan stated that the...
A city council member now.
Right. Stated that the West Side one was shut down because supposedly they weren't doing the books right, they weren't certifying things right, and they were going... I'd have to look at the video to get the exact quote, but they weren't running the books right. Now, my personal opinion on it, what I'm finding, is all of this is politically motivated. There's two factors. There's one perception that homeless meth-tweaking bums are stealing out of city cans and recycling and getting that money that belongs to the city. And the other thing, which was brought up, which Rochelle did point out in the tenants' forum, that when they steal out of those bins, it's costing the city money because they're losing out. And it's budgeted into their budget, all of this redemption money that is never really theirs. It belongs to the public. And so by shutting down these recycling centers and nobody can do it, most people will just give up and put it in the can. So therefore, the city is kind of in a theft-type roundabout way is getting the money that was never theirs, should never have been budgeted. This money actually for deposits, I told her if people aren't allowed to redeem their deposits, then they really shouldn't be charged in neighborhoods that Santa Cruz isn't complying. The lady, you know, agreed with me up in Sacramento. So that's the two factors. So they did shut down the west side. Technically, automatically, the two neighboring stores around there should have become required stores, gotten their 60-day notice, which is now they've gotten 30 days into the notice because I did call Sacramento and make them aware of all the non-compliance problems. But then there's been for quite some time now that Santa Cruz has had no recycling centers open. And the only people that have taken the recycling has been New Leaf downtown, which is not in compliance because they only allow you about 10. And I have to say that I had about 40 when I got the $2.15.
And then ten what?
10 items. Uh-huh. So that's ridiculous. They're not allowed to put a limit on. The only way that they can get out of not being a required store, which Safeway on Morrissey's has done and Trader Joe's has done, is they paid a $100 fine a day so that they are a required store. But none of these other stores in any other part of Santa Cruz, and this came right from the woman in Sacramento when she was looking on her computer, none of the other stores have paid that $100 fee, so they should have been required. So they've been out of compliance. And so the other store that takes it is Staff Alive, and they'll take at most 50. And like I said, to recycle $2.15, that was about 40 containers. So the people that bring in and count on that $25 to $30, you know, the middle income, middle class income, soccer moms I saw.
We're talking about recycling 400 or 500 items. You have recycled 40 items, you only got $2.15.
Right. So
you recycle 400 items, you got $30.
And so newly...
Are they carrying those many items when you saw them?
Yes, yes. They would bring in bags.
Like a number of cans,
a lot of plastic bottles, smaller bottles, water bottles, soda bottles, there was glass. And then when you do, even water has this deposit, like I have to buy distilled water for something that I use. And there's a 10-cent deposit on it because it's larger, so it's got two deposits. So people were bringing in and filling up these trash bins that you put it in to stand in line. And so they were filling them up with hundreds because it's really not worth the gas money, especially if you have to go across the county to recycle it. And that was never the intention. Cities were never supposed to believe that that money was theirs and put it in their budget and count on that money because it really belongs to the consumers. So when a city goes out of its way by saying things are not following the rules and shutting them down so that there's no compliance whatsoever, they're in a way forcing you to use their cans or waste gas and time to go to other cities to recycle, which was not the intent of the program. I spoke with a lady named Cassandra, and we spoke over three or four times, about 45 minutes to an hour each time. So the city claims, I got a voicemail, I guess it was about a week and a half ago, from Nancy Concepcio, who is in charge of this recycling, stating that Santa Cruz City was in compliance, that I misinformed the state. And she said that they approved the Costco, again, which is a self-serve one, to reopen. And so it's ePlanet's fault that it isn't open because they have to get all these permits. But isn't the city responsible for the permits? And if they haven't approved the permits, and the center, both centers, the only two centers in Santa Cruz have been closed down, then the city is responsible for it. So she tried to pass off misinformation to me, but she wasn't aware how much information I got from Sacramento.
And the misinformation that she was trying to pass off was what?
That the city's not responsible for Santa Cruz being out of compliance, that they're totally in compliance.
So was she saying that the city wasn't responsible, or that her department wasn't responsible because they, you know...
She said the city wasn't responsible. But the city issues the permits that...
Which department issues the permits?
She's Public Works.
So she issues the permits, you're saying?
Right, they issue them.
So they put a bunch
of permits onto this ePlanet self-serve recycling that they haven't been able to meet all the permits. And everyone knows about permits in Santa Cruz. In order to get your permits acted on in a timely manner, you either have to know someone or bribe someone.
So, I don't know if that's the case. Everyone may know that, but I don't know that. So I'm just saying
it's really hard to get your permits through, and that it takes a long time. And so by them sticking it in the permit process, it's still the city.
So did she give you any indication of how long it would take to get permits, or what the problems were with re-permitting Costco's?
She didn't say the details, but when I spoke with Cassandra, she was saying they were requiring things like... cameras on the self-serve. So what I need to do is, my brother's going to do a FOIA request of all these self-serve ones in Sacramento, which is a bigger city, that are in parking lots at all kinds of stores everywhere, and to see what kind of restraints that the state puts on them and what kind of restraints the city of Santa Cruz is putting on them. And we'll find that there's a lot more restrictive permits required so that it makes it hard for them to reopen. So by not giving permits or making a lot of outlandish restrictions on what they have to do to get approved and permitted, they're keeping these things closed.
So other than the camera thing, do you have any other idea what other restrictions are supposedly
being? I have to do a FOIA request, but I did want to look at what the state requires first to compare what Santa Cruz is requiring.
What did your friend or your woman in Sacramento, Cassandra, say the state requires as far as...
She sent me a link, and it's pretty minimal, and cameras is not on it.
Uh-huh.
So, and also the lady at the city, Nancy, said that they hope to have ePlanet up and going in Costco. That's only one recycling center.
What is ePlanet?
ePlanet is the company that does the recycling.
Have you talked to them?
I haven't talked to them because I was put on hold for so long waiting, but I am going to follow up with them because I want to find out from them if they're willing to tell me all the restrictions that the Public Works and Transportation Commission has required of them, which Rochelle is a sitting member. She's not the chairman, like when the West Side plant was closed down, but she sits on that commission.
On what commission?
The Public Works and Transportation Commission.
I don't think she is anymore. It's an advisory commission. She's a city council member.
She might have changed, but last December she was on it.
Until she was sworn in, yeah, probably.
She was part of the RV restrictive parking. I saw her at the meeting that day.
So, now I know that you draw all these things together, and it's not necessarily wrong. You know, RP parking, of course, is the initiative by the Public Works Commission to shut down parking around the Circle's Church, or require the people to get permits to be there. And there's also, then that was passed, actually, by the Parks, the Transportation and Public Works Commission, even though most people in the audience kind of opposed it, although they said they didn't mind if it was extended further. And the point was to stop homeless people from parking their vehicles at night.
The perception.
And that was partially because the Circle's Church for a while, for a number of years, was providing a significant number of services to homeless people in the wee hours of some of the mornings that you were a part of, Pat.
Right, and I didn't see all these RVs and people pooping in people's lawns or drug users, because we stayed on top of who we fed, because I, as a single woman, would not be volunteering.
I know that you like... I interrupt you because I'm focusing on the recycling here, and I know that, you know, you'd like to link all these things together, and indeed, there's a case to be made for linking...
Lots of salt on the
homeless. A case to be made for linking them together. There's a case to be made, if I can finish my sentence over here, Pat, I'll have to turn off your mic if you just keep stuff. You know, I think what we really want to get to here, and you've given us some useful data, is what the specifics are around the recycling. I'm trying to draw up. I don't think much was written about it during that Public Works and Transportation Commission hearing, and I don't know when it was, whether it was 2014 or 2013. It was a while back, where there was an attempt by a number of neighbors to essentially put strong restrictions on recycling centers in an attempt to shut them down, and they failed. They could not shut them down through that process. I heard later that they were shut down because of financial problems. But again, I didn't get clear information. I don't remember the source that I got that from. So I don't know. Have you actually talked to the recycling centers to find out why they say they were shut down?
I haven't had that, but I did talk to the woman in Sacramento who's in charge of all the compliance. And I know from talking with her and the email that I have sent, which I'll be... I got sick, so I wasn't able to do an article and publicly post all the information, that Santa Cruz is definitely out of compliance and in trouble.
No, I understand that. I would encourage you to go talk directly to the people who are running the recycling centers and ask them why they shut them down. See what they say, anyway, because it would be useful to hear their story. I know that you also have planned to, you're obviously pissed about this because you've been a homeless advocate for a number of years now, and a concern that people be treated like human beings and not like bags of trash. And frankly, Public Works, If you see their publication, if you may have seen it, it's available free in the city council offices. It's a little four-page newspaper they put out. And they actually were urging people to turn in scavengers, as say people who were taking cans and so forth from yeah, that's one thing. But I don't think they were putting it that way.
But that's I think
they were putting it in terms of that these were dangerous kind of people who were stealing things from you, from your recycling bins and menacing your areas, and which belong to the city. So it's interesting to look at their publications. You might want to do that if you haven't already. And, go ahead, but we're going to move on pretty quickly after this.
Yeah, I just want to make the point on the can. It says once this thing has been put in the can, it belongs to the city and you cannot take it out. And that's the theft that they were talking about. But if there's no recycling plants or anywhere to redeem these, then more people are going to put them into the can. So the city's going to get more money. So ultimately, this is more about money. And it's not just advocating for the homeless is the reason I looked into this. My brother likes to drink a lot of flavored water, and those deposits add up. And so it was just like everybody else feels. I just want to get the money back that's guaranteed me. And if the city's stealing it from me and is blocking me from getting it, then stop taking it from me. It's just, a civil rights issue. It's like taxation without representation. And that's what this came down to. And so it's been a problem for some homeless people because they aren't recycling and they do count on that money. And they clean up the environment doing that. So that's all I really have to say. I just want to say again, if you have run into any issues where you aren't able to redeem your recycles, make sure and call the complaint line. You can also email them if you go to calrecycle.gov. But it's 1-800-RECYCLE or 1-800-732-9253. Because that day that I did the recycling, I had to call in 5 complaints.
Give that number again.
It's 1-800-732-9253. And it's also, that's the numbers for the initials of 1-800-RECYCLE.
We're going to take a musical break. Pat, you're welcome to hang if you'd like and talk some more. We'll be talking about a number of other issues, too. We had a meeting last night of the so-called Camp of Last Resort that Phil Posner is pressing. They had a full house. The Cannabis Alliance also met last night in the Loudoun Nelson Center. They're struggling with threatened restrictions on growers and growing, which are coming up at the Board of Supervisors next month. So stay tuned. So that was our musical break, and we have, I don't know if it's a musical voice, but it's an informative voice of Courtney. Hi, Courtney. Can you hear me?
Hi, yeah, I can, and I have nothing musical to offer, unfortunately.
Oh, well, you know, you could hum as you... I'll hum while you talk.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
You're with Scene Baras, which recently had the huge, well, fairly large Cages Kill protest about a week and a half ago, 2 weeks ago. What's
yeah,
up? What are the four demands that you're making of the county, and how are they responding to that?
So the four demands, well, first to kind of lay the context for this, it's kind of hard to draw clear lines, especially after less than 2 weeks after the action. But there has been some interesting news in the Sentinel about Sheriff Hart and folks that run the jail rethinking what medical care looks like, and especially for elderly people, because the most recent death was a 65-year-old woman, Sharon Gibbs. And Sheriff Hart, in this media piece, actually admitted that more could have been done as far as preventing her death. So the four demands that we're organizing around are, and these are long-term organizing campaigns, but the first is for the County Board of Supervisors to cancel the contract that they currently hold with a private medical company that runs the care in these jails. It's called California Forensic Medical Group. They've been running the jail care since 2012, and they currently are up against a class action lawsuit, as well as, you know, having a very long history of individual cases of abuse and neglect.
The name of the group again is?
California Forensic Medical Group, and I encourage anyone, you can go online and just Google them, actually, and you'll see the plethora of issues of just corruption and abuse and cutting corners that they have on their record.
Fair enough.
Demand number two is to abolish the use of solitary confinement in the jail, as well as other forms of torture. One focus of ours has been something called the torture chair, officially called a restraint chair, that's used in Santa Cruz County. A man died in it 10 years ago, and people are still being put in this restraint chair. The intention, according to manufacturers, is not to be used for punishment, but it's quite clear that is how it is used by jail officials to punish and torture and scare people.
Have you put in a Public Records Act request to find out anything about the, you know, at least procedures and policies for using the chair, impact of the chair, you know, how many people have been put into the chair and that sort of thing?
At the local level, you mean?
Yes, definitely.
No, we have not done that. We have someone that is quite equipped and skilled and able to do that. But we're still kind of reflecting on the action itself and building some groundwork to figure out what our next steps are, and I would say that's definitely a possibility.
And demand number three?
Is to acknowledge the work done by the Santa Cruz grand jury and the findings of the report, which specifically, again, this can all be read online, but they specifically in the grand jury report found that there was serious medical neglect going on, that these deaths cannot be simply seen as natural occurrences that were, you know, happening according to someone's personal health solely.
We're talking about five or six deaths in the last 3 or 4 years?
Six deaths in the last 2 years.
Okay.
So we want them to implement the recommendations that have to do with expanding mental health services inside the jail. So there's a couple recommendations there. The sheriff and CFMG blew off all of the research and disagreed with the findings for the most part. And then the fourth demand, which kind of ties into the bigger picture, is to cancel the planned expansion of Roundtree Detention Facility in Watsonville. The county received nearly $26 million to expand that facility and reopen it. That came from the Board of State Community Corrections and has a lot to do with realignment. We don't want $26 million more dollars to go toward expanding this system. We want the county to continue prioritizing alternatives to incarceration and funding services in the community that prevent it altogether.
Where would could the $26 million now that it's been, you know, given to them for this roundhouse or whatever it's called, Roundtree expansion, could mm-hmm. it go somewhere else? I mean, could the sheriff spend it for other things if they decided not to expand the jail?
That's a wonderful question. No, that money cannot simply be moved over to something else, which is sort of the situation we're in right now with realignment, is officials are saying, well, you know, we kind of agree with you that alternatives are better, but this is where money is coming from right now, through law enforcement, surveillance, and policing, so we're going to put our hands in that pot of money. But Santa Cruz has been looked at as a really great county that is actually implementing alternatives and attempting to prioritize that. So we think Santa Cruz can be a leading county and continue that trend by rejecting this money, because eventually, you know, if it doesn't stop now, when is it going to stop? And Prop 47 that just passed, which will do some wonderful things, also has some issues in the small print. Over 60% of the money that will be saved from Prop 47 will be back in the hands of this board that is doling out money to county jail expansion projects. So 60% of the money coming from Prop 47 will go to the Board of State Community Corrections, which is primarily made up of law enforcement officials, not people from the community, not people that get targeted by law enforcement, no activists. So this is really a local issue, but it ties into what's happening all across the state.
So what's coming up at the meeting tonight that Sin Boris is having? I guess that's at the Circles Church at California and Woodrow?
Yes, and that's from about 7:30 to 9. Anyone is welcome to come, even if you're late. You can make it to any part to say hello and see what we're up to. I'm actually at work still right now. I'm going to go straight there, so I don't. Can't tell you the exact agenda, but we're definitely focusing on next steps after this action. And I know we're co-sponsoring a couple cool events coming up in Santa Cruz, such as the What's Just event with Inner Light and Barrios Unidos and a lot of folks.
Any new information about the homeless population in the jail and the impact of this? I'm not sure, what do we call it, the realignment, release of prisoners on the sudden pressure on homeless services that it may have created without any kind of, well, I'm not aware of significant resources being redirected in that direction. But any more indications of, I don't know, what percentage of the jail is homeless, mm-hmm. what people are facing there specifically, because that's our, at least that's my area of interest. I think in the studio with me is Pat Colby. It's also one of her areas of interest, too.
Yeah. Hi, Pat. Yeah, that's something that I think we all need to make an effort to really work on, you know, not just reciting the mantra that everything's connected, but really working together, because I'm hesitant to list numbers when I don't know the exact number, but just as so many people inside the jail are in there just because they're poor and they're in pretrial and they can't pay for their bail, and a lot of people are struggling with various mental health issues, and I know a huge percentage of people in there are folks without housing. And so I can't give you a number, but it's just clear every time we, like, have a rally, or, for instance, Cage's Kill on the 24th, when there's an open mic portion, or even just people hanging out at the clock tower, you know, we had our planned speakers and this guy came up and was like, can I please get on the mic, and talked about how he's been in that chair before. And
I remember that was Dreda, right?
Excuse me?
Well, I'm remembering that Dreda tried to talk to the rally that was the, I guess, a march against racism, and the organizers of that rally refused to allow him a chance to speak. But I think this time, you know, there was reference made, and you did allow some local voices to get in there, which I think is great.
Yeah, and of course, that, you know, we never want to police, you know, who has a chance to speak, but you have to do some sort of kind of organizing when you have people coming from out of town and on different schedules. But people spontaneously hop on the mic whenever that happens, and everyone has stories, especially people that are houseless. And we know with these local ordinances that continue to be passed, such as the stay-away ordinance that's now being trumped up significantly, that people without houses are consistently punished for not having houses and definitely funneled into the jail at a disproportionate rate and kind of cycle in and out of there, which is another reason why it's absurd, you know, that our homeless services cover such a tiny percentage of people who need it, and we need to be putting money toward those things and not expanding jail facilities.
Well, that's great. I mean, that was great. That's almost more information than I can use. But actually, Pat has a thought, comment, or whatever.
Well, I just want to say in support of you, Courtney, and hi. It's really, it can kill people or harm them severely, especially people with mental illnesses that are on psychiatric medicine. You cannot abruptly, which they do at the jail, take it away from them for I believe it's 72 hours or 3 days, because when you do that, you can cause brain injury or death, which is some of the reasons for those 6 deaths. And people need to know how important that is. You know, it really violates their medical rights and their civil rights, too, to just abruptly take away medicine like that. And that's really serious. So I wanted to point that out.
Yeah, thank you for making that connection, and you're totally right that people can read the grand jury. One of the families has a lawsuit, Drayer versus the county and CFMG, because he was not given medication that he was prescribed for multiple days, and he ended up taking his own life. But that begs the question, you know, what allowed them to do that? What pushed
them why
to
are
do
they
that?
Allowed?
Yeah.
Because it's a known fact. It says it right on the bottles of medicine. Do not abruptly stop taking this without a doctor's.
So okay. I'm gonna roll, because we got more stuff to cram into these 2 hours. But thank you, Courtney. Thank you, Pat, for
thank you, Courtney.
You know, giving us sort of an
calling.
Update. Sure. Yeah, and they can and check out the meeting in half an hour if you want at the Circles Church at Woodrow in California, and you know, look for more updates.
Thanks. You can like us on Facebook or go to seenbyus.org as well. Thanks, Robert.
Alrighty. Thank you. And Pat, you wanted to make a statement regarding something following up on the recycling stuff. I'm going to turn to something else quickly, but go ahead.
Yeah, so what I wanted to do is point out, I will be posting an article on IndieBay in the next week about the recycling, along with all the information that the woman in Cassandra in Sacramento sent me. And I'll also be putting on these 2 Facebook groups that I encourage people to join if they haven't. One is called Protest Santa Cruz County. And if you just type in Protest Santa Cruz, it's on Facebook. And what I've tried to do is make it a catch-all for all the events, any protests, anything going on. And when I'm usually not sick, you can always look there. Like, if you look on there, you'll see that there's something about Brent Adams' pint of beer fundraiser for the warming center. So make sure and check that out.
And again, that site is?
It's called Protest Santa Cruz County, but it's not really all about protests. And then there's another Facebook group that I started calling this, called the Santa Cruz Community. And like when I found out that the sheriff's department, the jail, needs donations of clothes and shoes, so that when they send somebody out from jail, they're never sent out on a cold night with a t-shirt, slashed jeans, no shoes, and no socks, because they say that, you know, they need donations. So I'm constantly posting things about donations that are needed or community events. And one last thing I want to say is
about that, have you actually verified that anything that's being donated is actually getting to people?
Yeah, right. We have a 45-minute video with the sergeant that runs the jail.
And what did the sergeant say?
He said about the donations.
He claimed it was getting to people. Did you ever actually talk to the people who received the donations?
Nobody knew about it, so that's why I'm trying to get it out there.
Have you determined if anybody has ever gotten a donation from the sheriff's department, ever? I'm just wondering, have you actually had a report from a homeless person?
Yes, I have.
And when was that? Tell me about that.
Oh, gosh. I've talked to so many people, I'd say in the last 3 months, that they were given a jacket or something.
How many people would you say you got clothes from the sheriff?
I've heard more had their clothes confiscated than
right.
Been
but how
given.
Many? How many actually got something that you remember?
I'd say about 3 out of probably 100.
And this was after or before you started publicizing a donation program to the sheriffs?
This was before.
And when did you begin publicizing this?
I publicized this, and I also put it on Symbaris' website. I did it, I'd say, about 3 or 4 months ago when we found this guy shivering at a Jack in the Box.
And what kind of clothing that you know of has actually been donated to the jail?
I don't know, because this guy was sent without any clothing.
Do you know if any clothing as a consequence of your drive has been sent to the jail?
No, but I will probably be going back there.
Okay. I'm trying to determine, you know, it's always
definitely.
Nice. These charity drives are all fine. I'm usually rather cynical about them, particularly if the sheriff's department is supposed to be running them. I don't regard law enforcement as a charitable organization, usually. I mean, there are
exceptions. It was an unofficial thing.
Whatever, you know. I want to make sure that we aren't spinning our wheels and giving false, you know, puff PR to certain
right.
groups that don't deserve it at all.
No, I have to go back
and follow up. Right, and if you do, let us know. What else have you? You said you had a third thing you wanted to bring up.
Well, I wanted to say make sure and sign up for those 2 Facebook groups, and also look for the article that's going to be coming out. And also, what I recommend to people is if you have clothing and shoes and socks, a really great place where I know that it goes right to the recipients is MH Can, run by Sarah Leonard. I have told all my friends to take their donations there because there's so many people that need them, and she is such a successful program.
Any information about reported attacks on MH Can by neighbors in the sense of attempts to withdraw or constrict Sarah Leonard's permits? We've had Sarah on the show here, and she's spoken about, you know, the services that her group provides. We've also heard some stuff that she's been, shall we say, facing some more challenges, if you want to use that kind of word. Do you have any information about
that? I have been hearing some of that. I haven't, because I was sick, I haven't been able to get back to Sarah
no problem.
Leonard, but
no
this
problem.
Is what I can verify. My brother and I went there and donated our time on Christmas Day to help them cook Christmas dinner for their clients, which was great because otherwise there would have been only 2 people. But she did tell me that Don Lame came to MH Can and asked her if the neighbors were complaining to him about the smokers. And he asked her if they could just let them smoke inside MH Can because the neighbors didn't like seeing them. And Sarah Leonard is incredible in her response. She just turned around and said to him, now, if I was an agency that protects for African Americans, and you came in and said that the neighbors don't like looking at these African Americans outside of here, could you please make sure they stay inside? Would you see it the same way? Because that's what you're asking me to do. And Don Lane conceded that was accurate, but he didn't apologize for what he had done.
Don Lane is a well-known homeless advocate.
But I thought you'd enjoy hearing that.
We actually heard that at the last Huff meeting, I believe it was from activist Sherry, that Sarah Leonard had set up a smoking area inside MH Can. So apparently she's responded to Don Lane's looks demands. After all, if that's an accurate account from Sherry, maybe it isn't. I don't know. I have to find out. Sarah's been invited to come on the show, but after maybe a hard question too far, she sort of has decided not to come back.
Robert's brutal.
But I try to be straightforward. But sometimes the questions, when you're talking to people who are part of organizations, are... Anyway, they can be piercing. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.3 FM, freakradio.org. I was going to play more, but we, as usual, I've been sort of letting things go over time. We're going to take a little musical break, and I'll be back again, maybe with you, with your calls, 427-3772, 831-427-3772 is the call-in number here. If you want to become a part of Free Radio, freakradio.org is our website, freakradio.org. A lot of schedules and... some archives, not so much of this show, but of other shows. You can get more involved, learn more about Free Radio, and maybe donate something to us. We need money. We need a spot where we can actually broadcast from. We're in the same position as we always are, as I come on and talk about in a kind of a repeated way. And it looks like we have a caller here. And let's see who's on the line. Hi, you're on Free Radio with Pat and Robert.
Yes, yeah. Hi, Robert. It's me, Sherry.
Hey, Sherry.
Yeah. I wanna make a comment about, you know, Pat's thing. Yeah, since Christmas, when obviously she, you know, saw that encounter between Sarah and Don Lane, well, things have escalated, you know, within the neighborhood about them, you know, not being happy with her, and so she has conceded that she now has a smoking area on her property.
Yeah, that's what I understood. You've been listening to the show?
Yeah. I was just listening to Pat, so I just want to make that clear that because I guess apparently that some of the homeless people, and she doesn't even know if they're really her clients or just other people, you know, walking up and down, you know, the neighborhoods. But because there's so much hostility right now, she has provided a area away from her main area so the smoke doesn't go into her
facility. What do you mean, Sherry, what do you mean by so much hostility? Do you have any specifics about that?
Well, that the neighborhood right now is because there's just, you know, quite a few of homeless people, you know, kind of, you know, hovering, you know, around that area, especially on Soquel. I don't know whether they're waiting for the bus or what the situation is because, you know, I go over there almost every day, so, you know, I see, you know, homeless people too, but just because there's homeless people there, we don't necessarily, I mean, I don't know, you know, if they are actually the clients of her nonprofit.
Exactly.
And so anyway, I just want to clear up, you know, that she is not going to send any of her clients out on the street in the neighborhood because of the fact that she has been getting phone calls, from, you know, the neighbors, plus, you know, I guess Don Lane made a comment at Christmas. And,
now, Sherry, I'm going to ask you regarding this. You know, the Homeless Lack of Services Center several years ago set up what they call a no-impact or low-impact zone around their organization at 115 Coral Street, in which they made it clear they didn't want their clients hanging out, that is to say, people who, shall we say, you know, thought they were full-scale members of the American community with all the rights and privileges that they should have, are not going to be allowed to be on the public sidewalks. Is this what Sarah Leonard has been saying to the MHCAN people?
Well, no, she hasn't really. I mean, I know she had a meeting today, and I was upstairs doing paperwork, but as far as down there on Coral Street, is that there is a lot of people hanging on the sidewalks and on the streets around Coral Street. So, you know, but like I say, you know,
Sherry, what is your point that they shouldn't be hanging?
I mean, you were just saying that you know, that the that they weren't going to allow people hanging around. Well, there is people hanging around outside.
What I'm saying is, no, you can't tell people that you don't allow them to hang around on the public sidewalks. They have a right to be there, just like you can't tell them they can't use the parks, just like you can't create an unconstitutional process.
No, I mean, I totally agree with you.
So what I'm saying is private organizations that are getting some kind of funding are now being pressured to treat homeless people like second-class citizens, and not only in their own groups, in their own organizations, on their own property, like with security gates and ID cards, which I'm not saying MHCAN has. I don't know what their situation is. But I'm outside, where there is supposed to be freedom to be. Now, my question is, are MHCAN clients being told, you can't hang around outside or we're going to remove the services from you? Or, you know, how is she dealing with the situation? She already, as you said, has pulled in her horns on the smoking thing. Not that I'm a big fan of smoking, mind you, but...
Right. Yeah.
So what's the deal?
The secondhand smoke. Yeah. Right. Is that I haven't been a part of those you know, meetings right now to know that for a fact.
But, I don't know.
Yeah, no, I don't know at this time, but, you know, I mean, if Sarah gets on to your radio show, I'm sure she'll go and tell
Pat
you
has
what
a question,
you know, her
report.
Opinion is.
Pat has a point. Go ahead, Pat.
Well, I just want to make, it's clearly been shown in studies that a lot of people, not homeless, but a lot of people with mental illnesses do smoke because smoke can calm them down from the anxiety. And also, Don Lane was incorrect in what he asked for, because according to Americans with Disabilities Act, and when you get grants federally, you cannot have you have to have areas for people to smoke, but you have to make sure the buildings are smoke free. So he didn't care if other people got exposed to secondhand smoke. He just wanted to appease the neighborhood. Well, we don't have to look at them. I've seen lots of people on SoCal even smoking by the benches of the bus stops, and they're not even her clients. So this collateral of saying anyone that looks like they could be one of her clients she's getting punished for is outrageous.
So let me ask you, Sherry, on another issue, and this is something that actually I'm already late. I'm supposed to call someone up in Northern California on this issue, but let me get a brief update from you. You were at the Cannabis Growers Alliance, is that what it's called?
Right.
Uh-huh. And that was yesterday. I guess they've been holding regular meetings because, as we talked about in a previous show, Board of Supervisors has attempted to crack down on them by actually implementing legislation that they wrote some time ago, and then I guess adding some new laws as well regarding the size of grows, regarding zones in which people can grow, which apparently significantly impact lone growers or small numbers of growers who now can't really grow if these ordinances are passed. And the cannabis, there seemed to be some real concern when I walked into the room last night. I went to the Loud Nelson myself, happened to go in toward the end of the meeting, and there was some concern. I'm interested in the issues there, but I'm more interested in the issue that has come up at Huff, which is Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, where our concern, or my concern, some are apparently feel everything is fine or okay, that people who are poor are not getting access to medical marijuana because it's not being provided by the agencies that are, I don't know how required they are under county law. There's some kind of provision that either encourages them or says they have to do something, and I'm not really clear about that. I talked to Supervisor Leonard about that, or Leopold, sorry, about that some time ago, years ago, actually. I don't remember all the details. Do you have, and you, I know you brought up the issue of access to low-income marijuana at that meeting. Were there a lot of faces I didn't recognize, young growers, old growers, folks like that? Go ahead.
Yeah, well, I mean, all of the growers there, they are very receptive to providing compassionate cannabis to people that are disabled, veterans, and low-income people, and we are going to be talking about that more. And, because it isn't a new ordinance, it is an amendment to the 7.126 part of the ordinance that was, you know, originally created here in Santa Cruz. And, yeah, that amendment is going to specifically affect people of low income, people who are homeless, and people that don't have a landlord who will sign off for them, or people that are in a Section 8, because if you're in a Section 8, you know.
Sherry, what is the amendment? I'm sorry, I'm not clear what you're talking about.
Well, because they're going to, cut down on the size of the grow area, and, you know, from a 3.3, You have to have you have to be more like a bigger grower on a 5 acres, and so because otherwise you have to grow inside, and most people, because the factor of the electricity and the equipment to grow inside is very expensive, and there's a lot of problems, and this ordinance wants to cut down on the collective that usually people of low income that have a caregiver, that the small collectives, they grow for them.
We actually, We actually did go through this last time we talked on the air, but was there any further, what did the group decide they wanted to do around this? I think there was some action.
Well, we're going to start having meetings now. I mean, we're going to start having groups. So I will be able to speak about this more because we're going to be, you know, gathering in small groups. Like, I'm going to be involved with what has to do with low income, you know, disabled and, you know, veterans and homeless people, getting their cannabis, you know, and then like I told you, I'm going to go around to the 12 different dispensaries. And I'm going to talk to each one of them. Now, I know that the one in Boulder Creek, I'm just not, you know, familiar with all of the names yet, but I will get familiar. And I will also create, you know, some kind of a website so, you know, I can list, you know, all the dispensaries and where people can go to get their, you know.
Low-income stuff.
We are supposed to get discounted prices. Because the people of low income, we cannot afford the $240 an ounce.
Now, let me ask you, have you read the specific code section that, and if you have, what exactly does it say about the rights of low income people or the requirements of dispensaries regarding
that? Yeah, that's right. That is not in there. Yeah, the only thing I saw was that. Is that if you are connected with a dispensary, you know, like if I have given my script to a dispensary, then they will allow me to go and help them in their dispensary with the growing of the cannabis, and then I get credit, work credit, towards my cannabis.
So, I guess, I know that they were talking about, you know, more organizing, I guess a letter, they want to join the Farmers Bureau and make an agricultural issue, something
right,
to that
and
effect.
You're going to be talking to that lady, I don't have her card with me right now, but is it Julian? You're going to be talking to her, in fact you're supposed to be calling her, like right now.
I am. So maybe I should do that. And
Go and call her, and then we can talk more about this on Sunday, because I'm going to do some research Friday and Saturday, so when I talk to you on Sunday, I will have gathered up more information.
Sounds good.
If you,
Okay, Pat, I'll talk to you guys.
If you need any public records done for information, let me or John know.
Okay, great. Okay, I'll be seeing you guys at Food Not Bombs at 4 o'clock.
On Sunday? I'll see you there.
Saturday. I'm going for Saturday and Sunday. Okay.
Great.
Bye.
Thanks,
Sherry. Keep up the good work.
Yeah, for sure. So, let's get musical again for a moment. Whoa. And then we will try to put the call through to Julia, or Julie, who is up in Northern California, and see what she's got to say.
Yourself in leather, pose just like some work of art. You can talk to two about this week's band and where they are in this week's chart. And I hate to interrupt you when your talk is sport and score, 'cause only love's worth dying for. Living and dying for. Living and dying for.
business. Rub elbows with some heat and shit. Spend a long day's wages and some colored sugar, wine, and meat. Wish I could be the one to show you it's a stuck revolving door. Cause the hell's worth dying for. Living and dying for. Living and dying for. Living and dying for.
And that was a couple of numbers from, goodness, who is this group? Well, it was called Living and Dying, I can tell you that. So, on the line with me is an activist, Julia Carrera. Do I have that right, Julia?
Yeah, I'm a neutral third-party inspector, and I represent the Small Farmers Association. So, yeah, in a sense, you're right.
Okay, and also in the studio with me, Julia, is Pat Colby, who is an activist around a variety of issues, mostly on homeless civil rights. And so the reason I asked you to call is because I'm primarily concerned about the access of low-income people to medical marijuana. And I know that may not be the major concern of the Cannabis Growers Alliance you were meeting with last night.
Yes.
But, it's one of my concerns, and certainly, I guess it's an issue that some folks are concerned about, and who knows, you may have a concern, is that, and you're up in Mendocino County right now, right?
Well, our office is based out of Mendocino County, and we do have that concern, but we're in 12 counties, we represent 12 counties of small farmers that are collaborating and joining together to fight against corporate takeover of a very well-established multi-generational cottage industry, and we're trying to protect that from disappearing through corporate takeover. And part of the way to do that is to bring forward patients, the veterans, and the disabled who, with corporate takeover, may get free medicine from those corporations. But what we're pushing for in Sacramento is an exemption to their medical needs in regards to licensing and fee structures.
I mean, there was recently of course, you probably heard this before, a federal law signed, and God knows how it got through, done by Farr, our local guy, and some other Southern California legislator, that required the feds to back off on enforcement where states had okayed medical marijuana. What's the impact been in California? What's the impact on the issues you're pressing?
Uh-huh. Well, each county is very different on how that's impacting. In Santa Cruz County, you still have a pretty robust rating program going on there, and I would say that there's probably twice the robustness in the program in Mendocino County for marijuana eradication. Elsewhere, not so significant. We've been talking about inappropriate raids where people are condemned, disrespected, and treated like severe felony criminals prior to any kind of trial, guilty until proven innocent, that have really resulted in some misconduct of law enforcement in these raids. Not all law enforcement is doing that, but there's, just like in any industry, construction, acupuncture, even the grocery store clerk, there's always a bad apple in every industry or two, and that includes law enforcement. So we've been up in Sacramento bringing people who have been raided inappropriately to the pro tem of the Senate, who's the chair of the Senate, to the governor's office, so that they can hear their story and understand what's really going on. And the response we get from the Capitol is with regulation, that will disappear. Because there's no clear regulation mandated some uniformly throughout the state, it leaves gray areas for certain law enforcement to pick and choose how they do and don't want to enforce. And, you know, we all have judgments and biases in our life, and law enforcement has a nice spotlight on them in regards to the war on drugs that hasn't been successful. So we're trying to bring a light into all the inappropriate raids going on with patients and medical marijuana to try to end them, including putting cameras on officers.
Yeah, I'll buy that. You have this sort of federal mythology locally, the U.S. mythology about a federal system, which is to some extent true. And indeed, California's Proposition 215 sort of kicked off the ball for medical marijuana in 1996. And then, you know, because of the pressure from the states, the feds, you know, I presume one of the reasons they passed this law, which I wanted to ask again, how you feel that has impacted the state. I mean, we still see them going after the Oakland, Harborside distribution center, even though the city of Oakland is endorsing it. And I guess you're primarily concerned with growers rather than with dispensaries.
Yes, we're the Small Farmers Association, so we deal only with farmers. Now, that doesn't mean we don't deal with dispensaries, because we are running a voluntary regulatory system based on the Mendocino County permitting system, which is how we started. I was the inspector there, and the core group of our members, over 400, are those permittees. I lost my train of thought. I apologize. Menopause does do that to me.
No. There's a lot of questions being thrown at you here.
But the answer really is, I don't see any change yet. But I think we're going to see change slow over time. In regards to the defunding of marijuana eradication in California.
And do you think you're closer to Oregon than we are down here? I mean, you being in Mendocino, insofar as you're a Mendocino resident, is that accurate?
I am a Mendocino County resident. I live in Ukiah.
Yeah, and that's a county, at least one county away from Oregon. But Oregon has taken another step. I believe, aren't they a little closer along with Alaska, Colorado, and Washington to actually decriminalizing marijuana recreationally?
Yes, it is fully legal recreationally in Oregon, and they're implementing, or they're currently creating the structure for implementation of that. Once it's voted in, it takes about 6 to 8 months, even a year, to get up and running. And then once you're up and running, it takes another year or so to get the kinks out of the program, which we know firsthand because we ran a program now for 5 years, but the government ran it for two. And it was always changing because we're in new territory. You know, this is the end of prohibition. And if you read any alcohol prohibition historical books or even that book called The Last Call, you'll see so many parallels. It's astonishing, actually. It's a good guide for what we're going through now with regards to medical marijuana.
Now, yesterday you handed me a flyer, which you encouraged me to read, which I looked over very casually. But if you can you summarize the important information that you think the community should know about in that flyer in terms of, I guess, its economic impact of the marijuana industry? Maybe it's statewide, maybe it's locally up in Mendocino.
Sure. It's our first published white paper. The Small Farmers Association is a 501c4 educational organization. We offer certification of farms, not only medical marijuana farms, but non-medical marijuana farms. And our medical marijuana farms are required for sustainability and farm ecosystem to not monocrop, so they have to be growing vegetables, orchards, or animals in addition and alongside their medical marijuana. So what we have done over the last 5 years is on inspections, legal inspections, gather data based on the State Attorney General guidelines that were never really published but are a good guideline that were presented in 2008 by our current governor when he was Attorney General. Governor Brown. And what we did is we require, you know, in our closed loop system that you actually follow those guidelines. So when it comes to financial costs, you are to track everything and be reimbursed for your costs by your patients or dispensary instead of sale. And that includes the hours you put in for labor, you know, paying yourself. So on average, out of the majority of our members are in Mendocino County. Out of the 400, about 100 are in Mendocino County. So that, you know, definitely influences the numbers to be more Mendocino County oriented, but I don't think that we're far off anywhere in agricultural production counties, non-urban counties, more rural counties, at least in Central and Northern California. And what we did is we took an average of what it costs for one plant to grow and be reimbursed for and how much the farmer actually gets from that plant to pay their rent, buy their food, clothes for their children, doctor's appointments, you know, tuitions, et cetera, trips. So we compared that to the federal and state poverty level, and in particular, because of the large concentrate of our members in Mendocino County, the Mendocino County poverty level. And what we found, we found that the average cost to grow a plant is $1,200, which is rather high. And the reason is people are doing infrastructure to create a, you know, a legal, you know, permitted farm. And they're also putting a lot of nutrients on these plants that really, you know, honestly don't need that much nutrients. They, I mean, in Santa Cruz it's a little different because of all the fog and mold issues, but these plants grow in extreme weather conditions, hot or freezing, in, you know, Southeast Asia, Pakistan, Afghanistan. That's where they come from. So, you know, they're used to the extreme situations where they're not being fed nutrients. So of that $1,200, 75% of that goes towards expenses, which includes telephone, gas, automobile, everything, you know, a regular business would calculate into the expense of their end product. The remaining 25% is what the farmer gets to take home. In accounting terms, they call that net, you know, after you take your expenses out, what's left over, or a profit. So at 25 plants, that's about $15,000. And then we go all the way up to 85 plants, which gives you about $51,000. When you compare that to the California poverty level, the 25 plants at $15,000 is under the poverty level of a family of two in the state of California. When you get up to the 85 plants with the $51,000, and we go in increments of 10, and you could read them off if you'd like to. I don't have it in front of me. That is just barely above the poverty level of a family of four. The reason we did that is that in the media, there is a lot of hype about how rich marijuana growers are. And the marijuana grower and marijuana industry of yesterday, where those farmers did exist, no longer exists. The marijuana industry is a different industry now. And farmers aren't making the money they used to make. And as we face this corporate takeover of a very family-oriented cottage industry, it's important that the public get that information, particularly the government officials, because in this national economic crisis we're all trying to navigate through, many, many, many politicians and many, many people are looking to the marijuana industry to save the day. And if this were all happening 10 years ago, it quite possibly could have. But today, it can't.
What's the difference?
Well, I think more people have come to grow marijuana in California than ever before. We have a glutton of product right now. You know, people from out of the area coming to grow marijuana and make a big, you know, cash intake and then leave and maybe not come back, maybe come back the following year. There's also a failed war on drugs that has influenced all of this, in my opinion, quite substantially. And, you know, it's becoming ever more evident that that war on drugs really is a waste of taxpayer dollars. And in an economy where we can't waste a penny, more public attention is being paid to the fact that it's inappropriate what's going on.
And wouldn't that mean that there would be more favorable attitudes toward marijuana growers? You're saying now that there's less opportunity for, you know, economic salvation through marijuana than there was 10 years ago, partially because people are taking, you know, their profits out of the state. Is there some other? You also mentioned that the corporate. You're raising the corporate specter. Do you have any specific large corporations in mind? Or?
All that would be speculation because I continue to ask people in the industry where they get their money from, and they say it's their money, or they don't answer. So I don't ever get a clear path to start understanding what's going on there. I think that big money is coming into the marijuana industry. While I was in your community in Santa Cruz last night, just happened to run into someone having dinner that was out there from Colorado representing IBM investors in the marijuana genetics of Santa Cruz County. So, you know, whoever are funding those corporations in Colorado or Washington have their speculators here in California trying to make the next big buck, whatever way they can, in my opinion.
And have you, I mean, how is this impacting Mendocino and small farmers?
Well, a really good example of that would be what just kind of got planted in the media about Foxberry Farm and United Cannabis coming to the tribal land in Ukiah, just outside of Ukiah, wanting to build a huge indoor grow site similar to those in Berkeley and Oakland, when Berkeley and Oakland were trying to do that. And we're fortunate enough to have a Board of Supervisors, Sheriff, and District Attorney that recognizes the economy, the underground economy that has allowed rural Northern California to not turn into a desolate Appalachia and instead have small, thriving farming communities based on the economics of marijuana in our communities. When that all went down, our sheriff and our DEA immediately reacted, knowing that the last thing we need is corporation from out of our state coming into our community, a producer county, and producing more marijuana in a way that is not environmentally sustainable. Large indoor growth. So they contacted the federal government, Melinda Hague in particular, and asked if there was any authorization by them for such a venture, and there was none. So our district attorney contacted the Pinoleville Tribe and Foxberry Farm and United Cannabis and asked in a letter form many pointed questions about what's actually going on. Before they could be answered, Melinda Hague has since stepped in and halted the process. So we have great gratitude for the sheriff and DA in Mendocino County.
Who's Melinda Hague? I'm sorry.
The federal state attorney general, not the state attorney general. So she represents the Department of Justice, the federal Department of Justice in the state of California.
What about Santa Cruz? You got an earful, no doubt, of what the supervisors here are trying to do. What's your reaction to that?
Well, they, like many board of supervisors, are looking at some form of banning right now because of all the people that are coming in and growing in the middle of nowhere in these greenhouses with fans and lights running 24/7 in rural communities that have never had anything like that in the history of their existence. So it's causing a lot of turmoil for government officials. Partial bans, full bans are being looked at all over the state. And Washington also on cultivation. We've been doing field studies over the last 3 months and what's going on with the small farmer in the legal estate. And one of two things, they either go deeper underground or they lose their farm. So the small farmer, I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought again. I think we were talking about corporate takeover of the small farmer.
We're talking about the impact, about here, what you see here in Santa Cruz in terms of the particular laws.
Oh, that's right, what you guys are facing right now. I've advised your growers to do the following. One, write a letter based on some action that they've agreed to take, which is sit down with third-party inspectors, all of them in the rural Northern California area. I understand there's a new one that's just popped up out of a law firm called Coastal Cannabis Certification. Small Farmers does a four-tier best management practices certification. Clean Green does a certification. Your growers want to get the three of us in a room to find out what would work best. I also recommended that they don't have much time. You know, time is not on their side. So organizing takes time. So what they really need to do is give the Board of Supervisors a boilerplate program that has worked in other counties and the state is looking at as the state bill to make it work statewide. And get that in place until they can actually organize and get a better program or improve upon that existing program. And that's the voluntary regulatory program we run that the Mendocino County government ran for successfully for 2 years. Dale Geringer, I've heard him say this to several assemblymen now when we've been in the same room, and Dale, thank you so much for the support. He's told these assemblymen and senators that out of the 20 years Cal Normal has been in existence helping small farmers, the years that our program, our permitting program, were in place, they did not hear one complaint from anyone in Mendocino County.
Well, Julie Carrera, we're going to have to leave it there. Do I have your name right, Julie?
Carrera. Carrera. I like the marble.
Carrera. You're a rare one, Carrera. Okay.
Yes.
Well, I don't know how rare you are. I hope you're not so rare.
Me too. So do I. And I don't think I really am. You know, as people ask me to come and talk, more and more people are coming out of the hills that have honesty, authenticity, and want to fight the right fight for the community.
Now, will you be coming back to Santa Cruz at the next meeting of the California Cannabis Alliance or not?
I will be, yes, if not sooner. Hopefully I'll be able to come back quite often.
Do you know when that is?
I don't yet, but we're also putting together a tracking system for our participants, our volunteer regulatory, self-regulatory program, and they're based out of Santa Cruz. So we're, strawberry growers are putting it together for us. So they're in Santa Cruz quite often these days, so we will be back and we will be helping everyone there, and we encourage all of you to go to our website, www.smallfarmers.us, or on Facebook, and learn more about us and join if it's in your heart to do so.
Again,
now
small
more than ever, people, we need to unite. Otherwise, everyone's going down with this corporate takeover.
Indeed. Julia, what again, smallfarmers.?
U.S. Smallfarmers.us.
Sounds good. I thank you for calling in and dealing with your phone. Did pretty well, so good work.
You did, and thanks for thinking of us and including us in your community. We look forward to talking to you again.
Yeah, you're a source of information. I appreciate that.
You're welcome.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
So you're tuned to Free Radio, 101.3 FM, freakradio.org. You'll keep hearing us as long as we keep trying, and we'll keep trying as long as we have a transmitter site, and we'll know. We're not going to know how long that's going to be until probably a few days before they foreclose on the place we're in. Woo-woo. That means we go down. We'll still be on the Internet until such time as which broadcasters lose hope, because if you're not broadcasting, a lot of people are not interested so much in Internet radio. Might as well do something at home. So if you want to see that change, you need to get in touch with us. Tell us where is a good spot we could be. If you know where is a nice tree or a second story of a house, somewhere in the Santa Cruz area, preferably right outside the downtown. Downtown Santa Cruz is kind of in a depression area. Let us know. Go to freakradio.org, freakradio.org. Give me a call on the Huff line, 423-HUFF, 423-4833. And Yeah, that will be helpful for us. Was going to do an interview with Ray Glock-Grunike today, but Ray, who's been to China, he may have been caught down, or maybe he's been stuck in a Chinese restaurant somewhere, but he is not showed up. He is he's a bad boy for not showing up, but that happens sometimes. There is going to be a city council meeting next Tuesday, and we have a flyer here from the SCRAM, Santa Cruz Resistance Against Militarization, which is a group that is trying to, they're focusing a lot on this Bearcat vehicle, which is, I call it a tank without a turret, or, a, you know, it's an armored personnel carrier that was passed by the city council under the, oh, you got to do it right away approach by the sheriffs, I should say, the Santa Cruz Police Department. And that has been questioned rather seriously by some, and we haven't gotten any adequate answers, as far as I can hear, from Vogel, the police chief, Don Lane, the mayor, Martine Bernal, the city attorney, actually, sorry, I say the city manager, or the city attorney for that matter. I'm not sure if it's Barisoni or Condotti. It's one of the two. I think they're... And I'm sorry, did you have something to say about this?
Oh, there's another one with the last name of Reed. Oh, there's another city attorney.
There are a bunch of them, actually. The office is full of them.
But Barisoni seems to be taking the far seat in the back now, letting the others do his work.
It could be.
I
in any case,
to say dirty one.
I don't know what's on the agenda. I won't know until it may be out now, but there really isn't adequate time to look at it. So I think what I'm going to do is try to play a few words from people who I chatted with at the Red Church recently. That's the church every Monday that, you know, chows down. And I was there running around with my little tape recorder or audio recorder. And we can hear what they were up to. And that's what we're going to do. Call-in number here is 427-3772 if you have any news or updates. And you can talk to me or Pat if you do call in.
Well, it's a shorter line at the Red Church tonight. It's about 6:25, and I'm here talking with a woman with a pooch in her arms.
A couple pooches.
Oh, wow, that's right. There are more than one. Looks like you got a collection there. What's your name, madam?
Cruella DeVille.
Cruella, you say you have some news about someone's getting into the hot water or not getting the hot water. Or...
Yeah, hot water. Valero's, I was told by a clerk at the Valero across the street from Vintage Faith Church on Mission Street that they're no longer going to serve hot water because there seems to have been a problem with homeless people standing in line and blocking the paying customers from accessing the cooler or something to that effect.
Valero's, I'm a little bit uncertain about that.
That's a gas station, and it's also a convenience market, and there's a few of them. There's two on Mission Street, and then I think... maybe one on Ocean, and another one in Midtown, in the Seabright area, I believe, maybe by Frederick Street and SoCal. But apparently, I wanted to purchase some water, and they said that they would make an exception, a one-time exception.
Your attractive hat? To...
I don't know. Probably because of the amazement on my face. They felt shocked. We all were shocked at that moment. It was a mutual shock, but... They sold me some hot water and told me that they'd make an exception this time because I didn't know about this new change. I asked if this this water ban was going to be posted in any way, and they asked me if they wanted me to post it. They would be more than happy to post this hot water ban. And
like for tea and such?
Or? Well, maybe if some parents were traveling and had a baby formula and needed some hot water, they probably should go to 7-Eleven or Starbucks or something.
Mm-hmm.
Emily's Bakery on Mission Street now charges 50 cents for a cup of hot water, so just bring some quarters along. If you're on a medical diet, like say you might be celiac and you just can't go into restaurants, you should probably bring your own hot water or know where the nearest 7-Eleven is or Starbucks.
How long has this policy been in effect? You know?
This is a new thing. This is news to me.
What day did you learn this?
This was last night, Sunday night. So there you go. There you have it.
Any news about cold water, frozen bottles being thrown at people?
We'll get into the cold water in a minute, but you say, Pat, you say you have some additional info on this?
Well,
it's like they're talking about paying customers, but they're charging $1 for a cup of hot water. That sounds like they're paying customers as well and being overcharged.
Yeah, but they're only homeless people.
Oh, so they don't count. I mean, if
they count, but they count for less. They've got less money, so they count for less.
But
what's wrong with you?
But don't you think $1 for a cup of hot water is like gouging them? I mean,
well, you do what the market will be. Haven't you ever heard of neoliberalism? What is your deal, woman?
Well, but whenever you're paying for something, you're a paying customer, whether you're homeless, housed, or
yes,
in between.
But there are the good paying customers, and there are the shady paying customers.
And if they're not doing bad social behavior.
Yeah, but they probably will later. You're enabling it.
Oh, yeah, and enabling those hot water junkies.
Let's hear some more from our guest, the victim at the Red Church.
People in the near, in the last few days?
No, I haven't heard about that. Is that happening?
I don't know.
I wanted
to know if there are any updates. I know that Mrs. B was reporting it had happened on Highway 9 as you approached the homeless lack of services center.
Cold water bottles, like water, like just Alhambra or Crystal Springs or...
I'm not sure what the brand was, but the notion was that it was a... sort of a missile when frozen water can be...
Oh, boy, that's not good. Okay, yeah, that's...
But again, I don't know. I haven't got...
Wow.
This is the report I've gotten from Shannon, I think, and from one other person.
Yeah, I called when they were on the highway throwing the river rock projectiles, catapulting the river rocks. I used to call them the boulder snipers. So maybe we have some ice water snipers now. Wow.
I see. We've been talking with...
Hot water Julie Shaw.
Thank you, Julie. Appreciate that. Oh, it's a shorter line at the Red Church. We're talking with
Mia Cook.
Mia, you're standing next to a backpack that's about three quarters your size, but it's narrow, but it's tall, and you're about what, 5'4"?
Yeah.
And you say Starbucks decided they didn't want your backpack in there, either in the store or the cafe or in the outer area?
Right.
And is this an unusual decision? Is it new?
Yes, it is. I mean, for years everybody's been taking their packs in there, and now all of a sudden...
It's backpack bigotry.
Yes.
As I call it.
Well, but I think the businessmen can still have their packs.
Well, naturally. All you got to do is get yourself a decent job, a living wage, perhaps a more upscale car. Be all right. What's wrong with you?
Well, I don't know. Cancer. I have cancer.
Oh, you see, now, that's kind of depressing for people in Starbucks. You don't want to take that kind of thing around ordinary people, now, do you?
No.
You know, show a little consideration. I mean, you can go off quietly and die somewhere.
I could.
Yeah, I think that's what it's expected of you.
Or I could just show up every day and make sure that they know my face is still going to be around.
That you could, too, for sure. Now, how often had you been using Starbucks before?
Actually, I would spend about $7 in there a day.
And was that, like, every day, pretty much?
Yep, every day.
And you would bring in your backpack?
Yep. And it was all fine until they made the new ruling.
Now, had there been a time before, like a year or two ago, when they had a similar ruling, or is this...
No, they had talked about it the last time I was here, but apparently nothing was done with it. And when I came back this time, they just decided...
How long ago were you away, and when did you come back?
About 4.5 years ago.
Okay.
And they only spoke of it then. They didn't do anything.
We'd heard about 2 years ago or a year and a half ago that Starbucks, Pete's, and Roasting Company were banning backpacks. Hey, Jerry. Jerry?
Really?
Yeah.
I don't know because I wasn't here.
Well, this is interesting to hear. It may be time to have a special appearance at Starbucks with a number of us to discuss this issue with them and possibly with the general public coming in.
That would be nice. That would be very incredible.
Well, we did that before. Huff came down and started serving coffee right outside of the Roasting Company because we felt that there should be bigot-free coffee available to those, and we allowed people to actually have their backpacks while they drank the free coffee.
I would like that.
We're very liberal. Okay, well, if you want, come to the... there's going to be a Huff meeting on Wednesday. You know, here's the card with the usual... Actually, here, this tells you about it.
This that's, one that has,
that's right there. And Huff meets every Wednesday, 11 to 1, at the Sub Rosa Cafe.
Where's that?
Which is next to the Bike Church, if you know where the Bike Church is.
I don't know where the Bike Church is.
And, you know, we'll bring up the Starbucks issue if you want to bring it up. And maybe
I do. I think that's wrong. Because it's like one of the only places people had to go in to get out of the cold or the rain.
Yeah. Well, we heard the Pergolesi was doing something like that too for a while, and then they stopped doing it, and after we publicized it. So.
Oh well, let's take this.
You come, you talk, maybe we'll get it together.
We will.
Free coffee at the Sub Rosa.
I can't turn down free coffee.
Well, then we'll see you there on Wednesday.
All right, darling.
You've been talking with?
Mia Cook.
Thanks, Mia.
Give me a hug.
That was a nice hug.
Honey, I just...
Yeah. I just got an anonymous report from a renowned musician that Pete's has closed its bathroom the last 5 days, which he suspects may be part of the same sort of, should we say, backlash against the homeless. And the population here at the Red Church tonight is pretty sparse, although we are getting later. It's about 20 to 7. We have, 30 people in the room. Lee is strumming away on the guitar. That's who you're hearing. And Steve Blaich is serving bagels. I've just made announcements about the upcoming Monterey sitting band protest coming up this Friday, which may or may not be the subject of a caravan from Huff.
And that is happening, or is slated to happen tomorrow from 4 to 6, according to Santa Cruz Indie Media. I was going to go down there and join the gang, or at least played with the idea, but I'm told there's heavy rain slated for tomorrow, which will be raining out that protest. Also, I think you had something planned, right, Pat?
Sherry and I were going to give out cranes and coffee and brownies and information.
Say that again when your mic is actually on.
Oh, okay. Sherry and I, another Huff member, we're going to give out free coffee. You can have a backpack, bigot-free coffee, brownies, cranes, and information to the public.
Yeah, but now the rain is going to wash that all away.
Oh, yeah. I'm not going to stand in the rain. Just getting over bronchitis.
There you go. Good, wise choice. Let's hear some more from the Red Church.
There's also an event which probably has already happened when you hear this on free radio. It was the Wednesday, February 4th forum. Right now it's 2 days away, but it's a Camp of Last Resort forum. And it's about a proposal to allow homeless people to camp in the parks. And we're down to the last six bagels here. Steve.
And the Camp of Last Resort Forum, which happened last night, which I actually audioed, so it is it'll be available online. I wasn't arrested for audioing, nor was my machine confiscated by Sergeant Bush, which may happen again next Tuesday at the Santa Cruz City Council meeting. No. And Pat was asking me if Sergeant Bush was putting in an appearance, perhaps as a sympathetic police officer, at this Loudon-Nelson meeting, which Phil Posner hosted. Raven Davis, Steve Plage spoke at. Brent Adams was in the audience speaking, and the audience was packed. It was a full room. It was a small room at Loudon-Nelson, one of the smaller rooms, but it was full of people, and it was interesting. A lot of people signed up. In fact, I got more sign-ups in terms of volunteers for the fight against the stay-away orders than I think we've gotten in all of our police department protests at the Cop Corner, which I'm thinking of suggesting a fourth one, because we still are not getting Officer Azua's racial stats. That Bill Azua, he's a slippery guy. You don't know what the heck is happening with him.
What are they covering for?
Who knows what's going on with that?
Yeah, it seems like they're covering up his racial stats.
Well, you don't know. Maybe Bill is just shy. Maybe he's a little timid, you know. It could be. He's a modest guy. He doesn't want his record revealed so that he might be overpraised. I mean,
doesn't want it scrutinized.
You know, David Duke might fly in from Louisiana.
Heck, he could go from sergeant to, how Lamas went from sergeant to lieutenant after some bad stuff went down.
Well, he deserved every bit of it after he fractured Donna Dice's arm. I mean, Donna Dice was a known coffee drinker, and he had to smash that coffee out of her hand.
And then write her up for litter.
And then, of course, she was written up for, I think, resisting arrest, and I don't know about marijuana. I think originally it was for marijuana. This was many years ago, 6 or 7 years ago, out at Lighthouse Field, which now has illuminated all the parking places for RVs, where people used to park in a kind of a regular row there. As elsewhere around Santa Cruz, there is a gradual reduction and shrinkage in the places where people can park. We've already mentioned the Circles Church. And there are likely to be, we'll see on
Isn't
the...
Isn't Santa Cruz a tourist town?
We'll likely see on the agenda something eliminating RV parking throughout the city, or limiting it severely, because that actually has passed the Transportation and Public Works Commission. And yes, it certainly is. And we are a tourist town, but the right kind of tourists. Pat, try to show a little respect.
Oh yeah.
We're gonna play a little bit more of this, and then we're
usually
gonna,
when you're a tourist town, you try to be.
We're going to be hearing the actual boom, boom, boom of our friend. The next talk show host, who isn't really a talk show host, he will insist, but a musical show host, Uncle Dennis. I think he's going to be coming in, and I'm afraid he probably will be. That could be any minute now. So I'm going to play a little more of this, and then we're just going to have to catch me at the Food Not Bombs table with your citations for sleeping. We're going to try to file claims against the city for those, and we won't try. We will file. We already have. We're going to file more. And also, we're scheming on strategies around the stay-away orders, which go into effect in about a week. Actually, February 13th is probably the drop-off date for that. See you also at City Council. We're talking more on Sunday morning at 9:30, but let's hear a few more interviews before the time is up.
Plage is working feverishly to keep up with the strong demand for
tirelessly
he says, for
selflessly
he claims, for these bagels that are hotly, joyfully perhaps, in demand.
Appreciated,
and he is appreciated, according to one of his victims who's just walked away
yes,
with
sir.
A bagel.